favorite Bible stories. Absolute favorite. If I had to choose one, I might even choose that Bible story. The part we read today was just a portion of it. The awakening of King David, if you will. The previous text tells the sordid tale of when David saw Bathsheba bathing from his palace. Overcome with sexual desire, he sent for her. King David could have what he wanted. And soon she reports she's pregnant. David wanted to make it look like Uriah, her husband, was a father. David brought him home from war, but he was a fine and dedicated general who would not go home to his wife until the war was over. There was no question of paternity. David was the father. Because of this, David has Uriah sent to the front line where he is predictably killed. Lust, intrigue, power, and war are not new themes for stories. But more powerful than David's political position is Nathan's parable. It has more power than any court of law, because the awakening happens within David. In a court of law that has integrity, and we have somebody witnessing to the court of law right here with integrity, a judgment would be handed down that David is the perpetrator and Bathsheba is the victim. But the hearer of this story is left to ponder a bigger question. How does power make us blind to justice? How do we do better to protect the vulnerable? I see at least three truths in this story, and I suggest they are instructive for us as individuals and as a congregation. The first truth: David is trying to keep his powerful public image separate from his private life, which is compromised by his lust and lack of respect for Bathsheba and Uriah's relationship. The power of this parable is the power of all parables. We can imagine ourselves in the characters. As king, David can have whatever he wants. I submit that we are, generally speaking, repulsed by this. We want to cancel David and put ourselves on a pedestal. And yet, deep down, we know we too are blind. Our actions do, in fact, stimulate suffering around us. We tell ourselves stories justifying why our public selves are not in harmony with our private selves, why what we do does not need to be consonant with what we believe. While we are not monarchs like David, in some ways we have whatever we want. We have, in many ways, more abundant resources for living than David ever had. Food, energy, materials, access to natural resources. And we don't want fewer, we want more. Politicians are loath to talk about the sacrifices needed to protect life on Earth. We hesitate to seriously consider how our economy could be structured in a way that counts the real costs of what we consume and the harm to the ecosystems of the Earth of which we are a part. Like David, we separate our public selves from our private. The internet has just magnified this 100 times. We can post a facade of ourselves in a realm of little to no accountability. The whole of who we are has gone missing on the internet. Here is one example where I have separated my public life from my private life. I have thought, in quiet private moments, I could probably live for the rest of my life with the clothing I own. Or if I need new sizes, I could buy used clothing. The production of new fabric and new clothes is costly to the earth. And I also like the choice and the freedom and the beauty and creativity that comes with design. So my public self says I don't want to give up that creativity and choice. But in private, I hear my conscience saying to me, live simply so that the earth and all within it may simply live. Our faith community is part of this vast realm of our public and private selves. Most often we don't trust our faith community with the whole of who we are, the whole of our private lives. We need some privacy. And yet, I believe it is part of our faith tradition to try to be as authentic and whole and truthful as we can be all of the time. Part of being faithful together means continuing to ask just how honest and how authentic we can be together. The second truth. We are called to... Hold on, I did something. I got a new... It's still recording. The second truth. We are called to try to understand the sinner, whom we often characterize as the enemy, as the object of our disdain. I submit that we can only hear ourselves and examine ourselves truthfully if we can hear and empathize with others, especially those sinners out there like David. And by trying to empathize with David, it doesn't mean we have to agree with the tragedy of his decisions. We empathize to understand him, to see his humanity. We empathize to understand him and see his humanity. We try to understand so we do not vilify him and return to him the same suffering he brought to others. My empathic guess is that David was trying to meet his needs for power. I know you're saying, well, that's pretty obvious. But I don't want to leave this unexamined. Power is for sure a need that all of us have. Power to influence and contribute to our surroundings. We all need to do that. We all need to know we matter in the world. The tragedy, as I understand it from a Christian point of view, is when we see ourselves as more right, more deserving, more important than in influencing our surroundings than others. And this point of view leads us to slowly close ourselves off from the truths others have to give us. We withdraw into our bubble. And again, the internet has only magnified that possibility. Another need that David possibly had was for real connection and warmth. Having a harem doesn't mean you have even one meaningful relationship. Maybe David was a very lonely man. We know the tragic strategy that David used is alive and well, not only among kings and politicians. It's hard not to think of examples in our own time. You just fill in the blank of who that is. But believing ourselves more right, more deserving, and more important is alive in all of us. Some years ago, my son and a small group of friends went to a music festival called Bonnaroo. Anybody heard of Bonnaroo? Anybody been to Bonnaroo? All right, there's an honest man back there. Where they and the thousands of other attendees camped, ate what might marginally be called food from my point of view, drank beverages never described to me, and did things I'm sure I didn't want to know about fully. I and a bunch of other helicopter parents read the website backwards and forwards, sort of as a spiritual exercise, hoping it would enhance our ability to trust and separate from our 18-year-olds. Here is one of the pages of the website. Can we talk about sex for a minute? We love a good roll in the hay or sleeping bag as much as the next person. Just be sure your haymate is as excited about it as you are. What seems like harmless fun to one person can do lasting damage to another. I said, bravo. Say amen, somebody. I was celebrating. These words supported a call to empathy, reminding those at the festival to care and respect others' needs too. To use what I like to call power with versus power over. That's what they were broadcasting right there on the website. I would have added a bit more about the benefit of a committed relationship, but they didn't consult me, so it wasn't on. The organizers were not blindly hoping that nothing bad would happen. They created awareness by lifting up self-responsibility, and without it, the lasting damage we all can do to others. King David could have benefited from this Bonnaroo post. The third truth is very complicated, rarely black and white as we want to see it, for ease. It's easy to want to put things in one camp or another. And yet, as complicated as it is, healing can take place by speaking the truth out loud, as Nathan had the courage to do. In the book, Bringing Mulligan Home, and I have to confess, I haven't read the book. I heard a report on it on NPR. Bringing Mulligan Home, the author, Dale Mahridge, wrote about his father's World War II service, traumatic brain injury, and subsequent bouts of rage when he returned home. Anyone who knew the father's occasional threatening and violent behavior toward his family would label him the perpetrator, the sinner. But the situation was more complicated than this, and Dale knew it, even as a youngster. Dale knew it as a youngster that his father's occasional and unpredictable rage was, in fact, PTSD. Through Dale's extensive research, interviewing others in his father's army company, he found out that when the soldier Mulligan had died, Dale's father had been blamed. His father had ordered throwing a test grenade to a spot that turned out to be a Japanese ammunition storage. The explosion killed his buddy Mulligan. Dale's father returned home from war with traumatic brain injury and the weight of shame and blame, which he internalized all his life. Even though his father's PTSD grew milder as he aged, Dale was not at peace and so channeled his restlessness into researching and writing this book. A last stop for him was to visit the site where the explosion had occurred some 50 years before on the island of Okinawa. Dale observed a Japanese man conducting a ceremony at the site marked by a tomb. Dale too was moved to mark the occasion and was just planning what to do for himself when the Japanese man said to him in his few English words, "Here, I will pray with you." Together, they created a ceremony with no more shared language than what had been spoken. When their prayer was over, Dale went to shake the man's hand. The Japanese man hugged Dale and said, "No more war, no more war." That story always brings me tears. The three truths. We can begin to integrate our public lives with our private. So God's image can be seen in our authenticity. We can begin to do that, integrate our public and our private lives. The person we might want to label the sinner, our enemy, the object of our disdain, God calls us to understand and love this person. Three, healing can take place by speaking the truth out loud, as the prayer partners and Nathan had the courage to do. God is ready to receive us and support us as we do. Amen. So this is the time in our service when we share our joys and concerns. Are there any joys or concerns you would like to lift up today? Yeah.